I was in Vietnam, there was a Huey helicopter on one of the bases. And it had up on the very front end of the ship what is called nose art. The pilots will paint something on there along with a slogan. Whatever message they want to give the world goes there on the nose of their airplane or helicopter. And on this particular piece of equipment, the pilot had painted a picture of Wile E. Coyote. You know, the guy that always chases the Roadrunner and never gets it all together and always winds up getting hurt trying. And the words that accompanied that picture were, "Why me?" Well, the rest of the story was there was a bullet hole right in the plexiglass right in front of the pilot's seat. I think about that chopper every once in a while when I get in a place like this and I say, "Why me? Does anybody deserves less to be up here than I do? All of us are miracles of mercy, but I never, ever expected to do this kind of thing. It happened to me. I didn't go looking for it." So you just have to put up with what you have and hope that the Lord delivers something worth sitting through on a warm Sabbath afternoon. Well, this morning we saw how a powerful coalition of a great nation, great military power, and a great church can combine in an intentional alliance. An alliance that Time magazine back in February of 1992 called the Holy Alliance. And when it's all over, an entire great nation and its empire are scattered like so much junk. If you want to substantiate some of what I was talking about this morning with respect to how national leadership in this country worked with the leadership of a great world church, get a hold of that particular issue of Time. It's back in February of this year. It's called Holy Alliance. And when I read the information that the investigative reporter put into that article, by the way, one of the investigative reporters that also broke the Watergate story, a very, very well-known American news reporter, when I read the detail he had dug up, all the pieces fit together. I had come to many of the same conclusions myself. I didn't have the glue of specific information to put those pieces together in my mind. But believe me, when that issue came out, I was not the least bit surprised. I understand that that particular reporter is not any longer with Time. I may be wrong about that, but I think shortly thereafter he left the magazine. So we have seen how a powerful coalition of church and state can take care of a problem even as big as the USSR with its massive nuclear arsenal and its awesome conventional forces. The question is, why was the USSR targeted? Why did it fall? And the answer is because it stood in the way of a dream. Now, just for the purpose of really being clear as to what we're talking about, let's go back and review what the dream was. Keys of This Blood, written by Malachi Martin, beginning on page 15. Willing or not, ready or not, we are all involved in an all-out, no-holds-barred global competition about who will establish the first one-world system of government that ever existed in the Society of Nations. Once the competition has been decided, the world and all that's in it, our way of life, our families, our jobs, our religions, our badges of national identity, all will powerfully and radically have been altered forever. No one can be exempted from its effects. So there is the dream, a new, orderly, ordered world. But you only have half the story. Now let's turn to page 492 of the same book. I have been accused, more often than I enjoy, of looking like Paul Harvey, to which I oftentimes reply, too bad for him. But now let's get the rest of the story, shall we? Keys of This Blood, page 492. at his most specific, he, the Holy Father, insists that men have no reliable hope of creating a viable geopolitical system unless it is on the basis of Roman Catholic Christianity. Now, there is a little more to this story than I shared with you this morning, and I apologize for holding you so long before lunch. What I was doing was reorganizing the order in which I usually present topics like this, and the one I gave you this morning has to kind of get finished or it doesn't make sense. And so I compressed as much as I could, but it still took a little longer than I would like. What I did not say this morning because of time is that the Pope believes that this new world order is inevitable simply because he believes he has a direct mandate from the Queen of Heaven. Let me read it to you. Page 492 and 493. John Paul is following a timetable he asserts has been established in heaven. He fully presumes that what he does will succeed only if it conforms to a sequence of historical events he confidently ascribes to the immaculately sinless heart of Mary. Now, earlier, it is said in these particular words, and I'm going to add this so you have a clear view of what we're talking about here. This intensely active man in all he does is consciously and expressly seeking to implement a mandate given him as Pope by a person he venerates as the Mother of God. Now, I don't have time right now to go into the Fatima vision, that vision that began back in 1917 on May 13, lasted until October 13, in which the Blessed Mother is supposed to have appeared to some peasant children and left some messages for a pope that would reign downstream in time. It was a message for the pope who would be sitting on the throne of St. Peter in 1960. I don't have time to give you the details, but suffice it to say that two popes, John the 23rd and John Paul I, along with Pope Paul, actually probably three popes in a row, looked at that message, which was in a sealed container in the Vatican. They opened the box, they said, uh-oh, and they closed it because they didn't like what they saw. It's kind of like what they used to tell us in flight school. You know, if you're doing an emergency landing at night, as you get near the ground, turn the landing light on. If you don't like what you see, turn it back off. So at least two or three popes looked at that message from Fatima, this miracle, this believed to be miracle that occurred in Portugal. It involved the Soviet Union, and those popes didn't want to touch it because it was just too hot. John Paul II looked in the box, and he didn't like what he saw either. And then May 13 of 1981, he's in his Pope Mobile cruising St. Peter's Square. And out in the crowd is a fellow by the name of Mehmet Ali Aga, and he's got a pistol. He takes aim at the Pope's head. He is a good shot. He's hired because he knows how to hit what he's looking at. He would have hit the Pope right in the head, but at that instant, Pope John Paul II saw in the crowd a little girl wearing something on her shirt, which was a picture of Our Lady of Fatima. He bent over to acknowledge that picture, and the bullets missed him. Otherwise, he would be gone. He became convinced from that moment on that because it occurred on May 13, the anniversary of the believed miracle in Portugal, that the Blessed Mother was sending him a message, and that it was time to accelerate the tempo of history. It was time for the Soviet Union to fall and for Russia to be consecrated to the Virgin Mary. So you see the depth of conviction that this very, I have no doubt, very sincere man feels for the direction he thinks the world must go. So that when an obstacle gets in the way, like the Soviet Union, it's possible to get rid of it. Well, the question we have is, are there any other obstacles in the way of that dream? And as I said this morning, yes, there seem to be, one of which is nothing more than a document. It begins with the words, "We, the people of the United States." To understand what I'm going to tell you about constitutional law this afternoon, I want to take you back for just a couple of minutes to the time when the Constitution was written. Go back with me to the springtime of 1787. It's been a bitterly cold winter, lots of snow on the ground, and now the coldest of winters is turning to the muddiest of springs, because everything's melting and coming down. And across a bedraggled, soggy landscape, you see little knots of travelers trying to fight their way to Philadelphia, moving through all that slush and ooze. And their names are a galaxy of the American heritage. There's James Madison. He spent the whole winter poring through books that Tom Jefferson has sent him from Paris. They're books that explain how it is you establish an orderly relationship between people called government. And there's Edmund Randolph. He's got everybody scandalized because he doesn't wear a wig. He just wears his dark hair loose and he doesn't put any powder in it. But they accept him for the eccentric he seems to be. There's Alexander Hamilton. He will become the first Secretary of the Treasury. There's Ben Franklin. He's old and he's sick, but he's still up and around enough to be a part of this process, and he's remodeled his house off of Market Street. He's got a new dining room that's big enough to seat 24 people because the delegates to the Constitutional Convention are going to need hospitality. And, of course, there's the hero, George Washington. He rides into Philadelphia 6 years after Yorktown, still a hero. And the guns fire and the cheers go up, and over at Christchurch the bells ring. The time is May of 1787. The place is Philadelphia, and the purpose is very, very explicit. They are to write a constitution for this new thing called the United States of America. Well, over in the State House, they close the windows in the Constitution Hall. It's a kind of a small room, about 40 feet square. And the native Philadelphians know that this time of the year is the time to close the windows. Well, the New Englanders have come south, and they don't know what they're getting into, so they wear their woolens. And when they get to Philly in the summertime, they realize they made a big mistake. And they start griping about the closed windows, and they demand that they be opened. So finally someone reluctantly does, and in come the flies. In the United States of America, its constitution was formed while just about 55 delegates sit around these little green felt-top tables to the buzz of blue bottle flies. But by September 17, they have a document. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare and secure the blessings of liberty to us and to our posterity, do establish and ordain this Constitution of the United States. And one by one, the delegates file forward to sign the thing. Old Ben Franklin's real sick by now. He's so sick that he can't get to Constitution Hall without help, and so they recruit four inmates from the Wallace Street Jail, and they rig up a sedan chair, and they carry him there. And the old man totters up the aisle to put his name on that document, tears coming down his old wrinkled face. Because he senses that something very special has happened here. I think something special has happened that was foreseen by the Apostle John in Revelation 13. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and it had two horns like a lamb. The lamb-like qualities of this new nation, civil and religious liberty, would within 50 years make it possible for the Advent message to be given. And within 54 years, there's people like this middle-aged farmer named William Miller, a retired sea captain by the name of Bates, and a 21-year-old youngster by the name of James White, and they get the conviction in their minds that it's time for Jesus to come, and they begin to preach, and they can preach, because something happened in Philadelphia that guarantees there's an absolute right to practice your religion. So the Advent message can begin. Well, one of the first things that the framers of the Constitution do is to kind of say, oops, we left something out. And they add 10 amendments called the Bill of Rights. Amendment number one guarantees you the freedom to practice your religion, freedom of the press, freedom of speech. Number two gives you the right to keep and bear arms. Number three will protect your home from the intrusion of governmental soldiers. Number four, exceedingly important, is the right to privacy. You have the right to privacy in your person, in your papers, in your effects. Number five is which one? The right not to incriminate yourself. Number six, the right to a speedy trial. Number seven, the right to a trial by jury. Number eight, no cruel or unusual punishment. And then numbers 9 and 10 simply reserve to the people and to the states respectively the powers not specifically given to government, because you see, there is a conviction in the framers of the Constitution that government does not have power, it is granted power by the people. Now tell me something. Why did they find it necessary to build into the Constitution those 10 specific guarantees? Why were they thinking about that stuff then? Why? What happened in the past? What year is it? 1787. What is supposed to end in 1798? 1260 years of catastrophe in which well-meaning people, not meaning to do harm necessarily, only wanting law and order and what they think is truth enforced, make a terrible mistake. They weld together religion and politics, and they combine church and state. So mankind has been through a 1260-year nightmare called an inquisitional system of government. Now, what is an inquisitional system like? The Inquisition was a system whereby in every major town and city there would be someone called an inquisitor. And if you were suspected of not following the majority view of truth, anybody could come to the inquisitor and secretly tell him that you are out of line with the majority. The inquisitor would then take note of that and begin to solicit and investigate on his own. He would search for witnesses. And in those days, if you got very far out of line with the majority, it could be the rack, the dungeon, or worse. And so the average individual called in by an inquisitor to be questioned about their neighbor was acutely aware that the way you seem to be really part of the system is to tell on the other guy. And so there's an enormous psychological pressure to accuse the person that you're asked to witness about. Well, when the inquisitor had enough people willing to say that you are in fact a heretic, he would then send for you. And it might be in the dead of night. It would not be with any great degree of notice. You would be called in by yourself, no lawyer, no counsel, no nothing, and no guaranteed rights. And the inquisitor, who is a skilled cross-examiner, would ask you question after question which you are required to answer. If you do not answer those questions, then your silence is deemed to be an admission of guilt, so that you are required to testify against yourself. Well, it's not surprising that a lot of people looking at a system like that would say, hey, feet don't fail me now. And they would start trying to get away. Problem is that all the Western world was tied together into a very sophisticated information network. Because you see, there was basically one state church, one community church. So the parish priest in that community was the one through whom all information flowed, you see. And that parish priest would be given very regularly a list of people who were in flight from the Inquisition. And in those days, the towns were small. Everybody knew each other. You didn't travel a lot because it was just too difficult to travel. So that if you as a stranger came into town, you would be instantaneously recognized as a stranger. And if you as a stranger came into town and were recognized and were listed by description and name on the inquisitional wanted list, you didn't get very far. You couldn't get away. The world was closed to you. Now, if you were very, very fortunate, you might make it to the Southern Alps down in those Waldensian valleys, get up in high country, rugged country, way up there, away from the troops of the Duke of Savoy, La Palud, La Trinita, those soldiers who periodically went into the valleys hunting the heretics. That's the inquisitional system. And the human race had suffered under it. Now, notice if you look at the Bill of Rights, how many of them are designed to guarantee that an inquisition could never happen again. Number one, the freedom to practice your religion, to say what you think, and to publish it in a free press. With that kind of freedom, the Inquisition right away is virtually doomed. But look at Amendment number two, the right to keep and bear arms. You see, there is nothing a dictator hates worse than an armed public. Number four, the right to privacy, obviously designed to guarantee against a repetition of the Inquisition. What about Amendment number five, the right not to incriminate yourself? Obviously, it defends you against an inquisitor prying without privilege into your life. What about number seven, the right to a trial by jury? So you won't be tried by some guy in a little closed room who has ultimate authority over your life and welfare. It'll be 12 people like you, a jury of your peers. And finally, cruel and unusual punishment. By 1787, the human race has had enough cruel and unusual punishment that the founders of this country say never again. And the Bill of Rights is born, and the Constitution is born. Now, where do we find ourselves today? Remember, the Constitution is seen as an obstacle. Quite frankly, it is not greeted with a lot of joy, even in the 19th century, by some commentators in the world. The leader of a great church put it this way, and I'm quoting, "The absurd and erroneous ravings in defense of liberty of conscience are a most pestilential error, most to be dreaded in a state." And this same individual anathematized those who, quote, assert liberty of conscience and of religious worship, and those who maintain that the church may not employ force. Now, with that in mind, may I respectfully once again read from the flyleaf of Keys of This Blood. From the first moment of his pontificate, it was John Paul's purpose to free the papacy from the straitjacket imposed upon it by the major secular powers for 200 years. It was John Paul's purpose to open the floodgates of geopolitical change. Well, what's happening at the floodgates of American constitutional law? In 1962, the Supreme Court decided a landmark case by the name of Engle versus Vitelli. In that case, they made a clear line between church and state. As the Warren Court said, there is a wall of separation, and you do not mix church and state on either side of that wall. The case turned around a brief, non-denominational prayer recommended for use in the New York State schools. That was the school prayer case. And it provoked an immediate amount of commentary. Opponents began speaking up, people who didn't like the fact that we no longer could legally have prayers in public schools. And in 1971, the wall of separation went even higher and thicker in the case of Lemon versus Kurtzman. Now, I'm giving you these cases because they are landmarks in constitutional law. They are issues that are as current as today and tomorrow because they're being quoted in current Supreme Court cases, and we'll get to that in just a minute. In Lemon versus Kurtzman, back in 71, the issue was, can the state provide a financial subsidy for teachers in parochial schools? And the court said, no, it cannot, and it came up with a very sensible, a very objective three-part test that tells you whether governments meddle too much in religion. Now, here are the three tests. Number one, a law must have a secular purpose. It cannot have a religious purpose. Number two, the primary effect of the law must be neither to advance or inhibit religion. It has to be neutral with respect to religion. And number three, there can be no excessive entanglement between church and state. Those ideas collectively are called the Lemon Test. Kind of a funny term, but lawyers and constitutional experts have used it now for about 20 years. Well, after these decisions began coming down, we had a change of administrations, and for the past several years, we've had presidents in power who were Republicans, namely President Reagan and President Bush, and they felt very strongly about the direction the court was going. And so as Supreme Court justices began to retire or die, they were replaced by more conservative minds. And it's hardly necessary to comment that during those same years, we established diplomatic ties with the Vatican. So that now we have a situation in which there is a major question in the United States with respect to the role of government vis-a-vis religion. One magazine has termed it a holy war. There are two camps in this holy war. One of them is called the separationists. Those are people who believe there should be complete separation between church and state. And their argument is that the wall between church and state protects religious institutions from governmental interference. It also is well to note that in a country with 1,200 different religious bodies, it's kind of important to respect diversity. All of them have a right to practice. And finally, they say that religious exercises in the classroom may force children to participate for fear of being outcasts if they refuse. Well, that's their perspective. Now, opposite this point are a group of people called the accommodationists. And those are the ones who believe that wall of separation just got a little bigger than it needs to be. They believe that church and state aren't necessarily incompatible. They argue that the courts have replaced freedom of religion with freedom from religion. Now, let me illustrate what they mean by that. There's a law professor up in Northern California. His daughter was in a local high school, and he complained in these terms about the court's exclusion of religion from public life. He said, and I quote, "Angela Davis, a communist, was the speaker at my son's high school graduation. People have to listen to the most heavy-handed dogmatism, and then suddenly the Constitution is violated if an agnostic hears the word of God. This is absurd. If we have to put up with things we don't agree with, why is only God excluded?" That was his question. Now, how are you going to deal with that? I read that at one Adventist church, and a good brother said, "Amen." He evidently agreed, and you can understand the frustration of people who believe in God and say, "My kid has to listen to communism and evolution, but he can't hear the word of God." There's the argument. And they say this artificial separation's just gone a little bit too far. Well, it's quite evident that the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is tending in that philosophical direction. I think it was back about 1985, Chief Justice Rehnquist said, and I quote, "The wall of separation between church and state is a metaphor based on bad history. It has proved useless for judging, and it should be frankly and explicitly abandoned." That is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. A more recent justice, Clarence Thomas, put it in these words, "My mother says that when they took God out of schools, the schools went to you know where." And then he added, "She may be right." Now, is there a danger here? Is there a danger that you, as a very small religious minority, needs to be thinking about? Well, Lawrence Tribe, a liberal legal scholar at Harvard University School of Law, puts it this way, and I'm quoting, "The danger is that those who are not part of the locally dominant culture will be reduced to a sort of second-class citizenship." Now, Professor Tribe, let's test your hypothesis. Let's do it in the best place we can think of to do it, and that is in the well of the Supreme Court building in Washington. Let's talk about the case of Smith. I'll give you the exact title here. Employment Development Division versus Smith. That's the one that came out of Oregon. Let me tell you the facts in that case. You probably know them, but let's just kind of go through them together so we're all thinking in the same parallel way. There are a couple of Native American fellows by the name of Alfred Smith and Galen Black. They were members of the Native American Church. One of the sincerely held convictions of that church is that in order to experience the mystical visions that you're supposed to see when you're worshiping, you have to chew peyote. They went to a church ceremony. They chewed this derivative of a cactus plant. They saw stuff, no doubt. Then they went back to work. You want to guess what kind of work they were in? They were drug rehabilitation counselors. I do not recall from the facts of the case in the Supreme Court Reporter whether they were discovered upon a routine blood analysis. In some way, their employer discovered they were carrying vestiges of a hallucinogen in their bloodstreams. The employer called them in and said, "I just got two things to say to you, fella. Get out and stay out." They went down the street and found a lawyer. You know, that's what we do these days. We get a problem, we go down the street and find a lawyer. And our society is paying the price, isn't it? I got to say that of all the things Bush said in the convention, the one thing that made the most sense to me was what he said about trial lawyers. I can say that, but I have to agree with him, because we as a legal profession have engrafted some of the biggest nonsense on society of any group in the world. I once bought a wood stove. You know, what do you use a wood stove for? You put in some paper, you put in some wood, you light it, and it gets hot, right? That's the function of the thing. In the top of the wood stove, emblazoned in a place that defaced the whole thing, was this raised metal message to me. Caution, hot when in use. Well, why do you think I bought it? And we have the legal profession to thank for that. So they went down the street and they found a lawyer. The lawyer said, "Fellas, tell me the facts of the case." They explained what happened. They went to church, they chewed peyote, they went to work, they got fired. He said, "You fellas have a slam dunk winner. I can take this one all the way upstairs if I have to. I'll get your unemployment compensation for you." See, the state of Oregon said, because you were fired for misconduct, you don't get your unemployment insurance payment. And the lawyer said, "I can handle that, and I'll tell you why. A few years ago, there was this woman. She was a Seventh-day Adventist. Her name was Adele Sherbert. She lived, I think, down in Florida. She wouldn't go to work on Saturday, and so her boss fired her, and she went to the Florida Unemployment Board, and they said, 'No, you were fired for misconduct. We're not going to pay you.' She went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said, 'Oh, no, you don't, state of Florida. You don't establish a law that makes it difficult to practice a person's religion unless you can prove that there is a compelling state interest so important that it overrides that person's individual liberty.' Now, there have been times when there have been cases where the public interest was so overwhelming that the court said, 'That's just enough. We can't swallow that in the name of religious liberty.' I can give you a couple of examples that come to mind. The Reynolds case is one. Back in the good old days when the Mormons felt that having a number of wives somehow equated to greater holiness, which is something I've never quite understood. Good brother by the name of Reynolds was prosecuted for bigamy. His case went up to the Supreme Court. He, of course, raised the First Amendment issues. "I'm practicing my religion. You can't pass a law that in any way restricts the free exercise of my faith." And the court said, "Mr. Reynolds, we would like to accommodate you. And if we could, we would. But there are certain issues, such as monogamous marriage, that are so vitally important for the state that there's a compelling state interest. Therefore, the conviction stands." By the way, folks, in a recent opinion, Justice Scalia said the Reynolds case didn't mean there was no compelling state interest in monogamous marriage. That's baloney. So you see how that test is eroding? We'll get to that in just a second. Well, it should be obvious to all of us that there are limits beyond which you just can't go in the name of religious freedom. Supposing somebody came to the court and said, well, I'm a member of the Church of Satan, and child sacrifice is a validly entertained religious belief. At some point, you say enough is enough. The way you decide what is enough is you say, is there a compelling state interest in running roughshod over this person's personal convictions? So the lawyer told these two Native American men, I can win this case for you if we have to go all the way upstairs, because we'll have going for us something called the Sherbert test. Compelling state interest. Well, he wasn't counting on the Rehnquist court. Because not so long ago, guess what came down? Employment Development Division versus Smith. This case, which is recent enough, it has just barely gotten into the hardback reporters. It was in paperback, advance sheets until recently. Totally demolished the Sherbert test and said, in effect, we don't have to show any compelling state interest. All we have to show is that the majority wants it this way. Now, let me read to you from the opinion. I'm reading from the majority opinion. To make an individual's obligation to obey law contingent upon the law's coincidence with his religious beliefs, except where the state's interest is compelling, permits him to become a law unto himself. Now let me read you a footnote in this case that tells you why we as Seventh-day Adventists ought to be deeply, deeply interested in something called civil rights. Let me read it to you. I'm again quoting from the court's opinion. We have held that race-neutral laws that have the effect of disproportionately disadvantaging a particular racial group do not thereby become subject to the compelling interest analysis under the Equal Protection Clause. Folk, when rights and liberties erode for anybody, they ultimately erode for everybody. We are all in the same boat. Well, the court went on to say some things that I think you need to hear. I'm quoting again from the majority opinion. We cannot afford the luxury of deeming presumptively invalid, as applied to the religious objector, every regulation of commerce that does not protect an interest of the highest order. In other words, they will not presume that your religious convictions really are as important as an established majority voted law. And they go on to say, Mr. Smith, Native American, you don't like it, go back to the people of the state of Oregon and get the law changed. Now let me read that to you. Values that are protected against government interference through enshrinement in the Bill of Rights are not thereby banished from the political process. What they're saying is, you don't like the law, get them to change it. Majority rules. Well, thank the Lord, there's at least one woman on the Supreme Court. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recently spoke down at my alma mater, quite an interesting lady. And she put it in rather blunt terms, and I won't bore you with a lot of details, but there's a little bit of this I think you might find interesting. And let me read it to you from her dissenting opinion. The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to withdraw certain subjects from the vicissitudes of political controversy, to place them beyond the reach of majorities and officials, and to establish them as legal principles. One of them is the freedom of worship. For the court to deem this command a luxury is to denigrate the very purpose of the Bill of Rights. Now, Justice Blackmun didn't like the majority opinion very much either, and he put it this way. This distorted view of our precedents leads the majority to conclude that strict scrutiny of a state law burdening the free exercise of religion is a luxury that a well-ordered society cannot afford. So there's where the law is coming to with respect to Smith and the peyote case. Now, Elder Stevens has done an excellent job of keeping us aware of these issues, and I really have appreciated what he has put in the Pacific Union Recorder. And I have to stop right now and say that one of the biggest fringe benefits that I've gotten from this very undeserved privilege of traveling a little bit and speaking to Adventist audiences is to get to know the Adventist ministry a little better. And folk, there are good people out there. We need to support them. And we need to support this world church, because I'm still old-fashioned enough to think that with all its faults, failings, and whatever else we might say, this church as an organized entity is going to survive. I believe that. Now, there may be some personnel changes here and there. We're told there's going to be a shaking, but folk, we can handle a shaking. That's how we began. The disappointment on October 22, 1844 was a shaking. We've been through that. That's where we came from. We can handle that, and we can survive as an organization. So I just strongly believe in sticking with the church, and I appreciate the ministry of this church. And Elder Stevens has done a fine job of keeping us abreast of some of these issues, and I urge you to read what he presents in the Pacific Union Recorder. The Smith case certainly is one that deserves concern. One Texas legal scholar put it this way, that a whole clause of the Bill of Rights has been abolished. And on the really small and odd religious groups, it's just open season. Well, that's kind of strong language. Could it be that he's right? I'll tell you something that's happened. Down in Oklahoma, in the town of Little Axe, Oklahoma, there were a couple of families that brought a suit against morning prayers in school back in 1981. They became kind of the targets of community harassment. The children were repeatedly pressured at school. Why don't you believe in God? Why don't you want to pray? That was tough enough. And then one evening, the members of one of the families went to a football game. They came back. Their house had been firebombed. Now, what does Ellen White have to say? Maranatha, page 195. Human enactments. Laws manufactured by satanic agencies under a plea of goodness and restriction of evil, law and order, will be exalted while God's holy commandments are despised and trampled underfoot. All who prove their loyalty by obedience to Jehovah must be prepared to be arrested, brought into councils that have not for their standard the high and holy law of God. Those who live during the last days of this earth's history will know what it means to be persecuted for the truth's sake. In the courts, injustice will prevail. The judges will refuse to listen to the reasons of those who are loyal to the commandments. Now, with that in mind, let me share with you something that a good brother here showed me just this morning, a recent June newspaper entry in which it says that Southern Baptists, blasting what they call the moral breakdown in our society, talked about the need for observing the Sunday Sabbath. And they said, and I'm quoting, failing to observe the Sunday Sabbath in religious ways was helping cause the moral breakdown in our society. Now, I can understand their feeling that way. If you were not convicted of the seventh-day Sabbath, and if you didn't have a view of prophecy that warned you about this terrible explosive mixture that occurs when you put church and state together, wouldn't you think exactly what they're saying? It's a reasonable argument. I can understand how people get just fed up and get desperate. And I can understand in the future where they probably will, and it'll be very difficult to be a minority in this country. Now, let's talk about Rodney King. I was on my way down to the Ventura Church, Keith Mulligan's church, just a few months ago, one bright Sabbath morning, one spring morning. There was a Santana wind coming through, and the sky was just beautifully clear, and I drove through Simi Valley. Surrealistic calm. The jury was still out, you see. The verdict hadn't come in. Well, the next week I was on my way to Green Bay, Wisconsin. We climbed out on course and below and to the right. City of L.A. lay under a canopy of smoke from well over 500 fires. How much had happened in only 1 week? I think we need to talk a little bit about what happened in the Rodney King case. It's quite interesting that in the most recent issue of the California Bar Association Journal, they polled lawyers, and they said, should one or more of the police officers have been found guilty? What they're saying is, do you agree with the verdict? 72% of practicing lawyers said they did not agree. They couldn't see how the verdict could come in that way. Now, our question is this. All of us saw, more times than we really like to see, pretty graphic video of a man being treated, shall we put it nicely, discourteously. And then a jury goes out and deliberates. And they come to a conclusion that the great majority of people who saw that video simply can't understand what happened there. Well, this morning when I talked about the battle for the mind, I suggested to you that there's a problem in our society. A generation and a half of people have been weaned on something called television, haven't they? And when you watch that much fiction, inevitably you're going to ultimately have a problem distinguishing truth from error. Especially when the evidence you were called upon to evaluate comes through the very same medium, you see. Now, in addition to that, there are techniques today that are becoming highly sophisticated by which individuals can strongly influence you to do or not do things, and you are not necessarily always consciously aware that you're being, to some extent, manipulated. Believe me, one area where that thing is at fever heat is in trial law. It is so sophisticated now that lawyers carry computers into the courtroom that has rosters of jurors. We know what they decided in other cases, similar cases. We know where a judge comes from. We have a dossier on the people who will sit in judgment on the case. And lawyers now routinely, in big, important cases, practice before they go to trial. There are companies that will impanel 12 jurors. There are professional jurors who are skilled at analyzing how well you put your case on. You run through the whole thing. You put your witnesses in a mock courtroom. This jury, so-called, hears the whole case, and you try it at least once before you ever go to court. And the lawyers are becoming aware that there are ways in which to manipulate the mind and conscience of a jury. Now, put these 12 people in a jury box, and this thing of a man being beaten is played over and over and over and over again until they're desensitized. He's no longer a human being. He's just evidence. Now, let's talk about law enforcement and the issue of law and order, because we will confront it, and I'm afraid we will seem to be on the wrong side of that thing. Most of the police officers, the peace officers that I have been associated with earlier in my practice when I used to do some criminal defense, were thoroughly professional individuals. Good men and women who were doing a tough job in very difficult circumstances, and today's inner cities don't bring out the best in you, whether you got a badge on or whether you don't. And so I have to say that I have a high respect for the professionalism of the majority of law enforcement. I want to make that very clear. In our society, you see, we have a strange situation. We give to the cop on the beat a level of authority that nobody else in our whole society has. No judge has that much authority, no prosecutor, nobody. Because we give that cop the power to take human life. Now, if you should, for some horrible reason, find yourself as the defendant in a criminal case where the issue is capital punishment, if you were, by awful circumstance, found guilty, and the jury came back and said, we recommend the death penalty, your case would automatically be appealed to the District Court of Appeals, then to the California Supreme Court, and as you've seen over and over, not just there, but to the U.S. Supreme Court. It would get the most scrutinizing review. Best minds in the country would look it over to be sure that human life isn't being taken carelessly. That's the kind of review that we build into the system. The average cop on the beat can accomplish the same thing, that is, termination of a human life, and have no review whatever, except to come back as the sole surviving witness to the event. Now, I don't see any other way to do it. We're in a very imperfect, very violent world. We have to have people, peace officers, who can maintain order. Because if we get vigilantism, if you and I try to take law into our own hands, we live in a very dangerous, unstable world. So I don't see another way to do it. But what I do see is that when society grants an individual the right to become judge, jury, prosecutor, defense counsel, executioner, and court of appeal, all in a split second, that individual has an enormously high level, a very high standard of conduct. See? So that when I see a human being surrounded by enough beef that he could easily have been cuffed, and I see him being beaten, that bothers me. And it ought to bother the rest of us, because the jury didn't see anything wrong. Now, I know they saw evidence we didn't see. I know they were subjected to pressures we were not subjected to. I'm sympathetic with that. But, folk, the end result is this country is becoming an increasingly uncomfortable place to be if you aren't like the majority. And we are not. Great Controversy puts it this way. Those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order. Where did she get that phrase from? That's another plagiarism for the late 20th century, isn't it? Those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order, as breaking down the moral restraints of society, causing anarchy and corruption, and calling down the judgments of God upon the earth. The dignitaries of church and state will unite to bribe, persuade, or compel all classes. That, I think, is where we're heading. I want to close because it's a warm afternoon and I don't want to hold you much longer. But let me just very, very quickly tell you about the recent case with respect to school prayer. You recall just a few nights ago, actually, just a few weeks ago, if you're watching Tom Brokaw or somebody else, you saw the report that the Supreme Court had decided the Wiseman case. Now, Dan Wiseman was a Jewish father. His little girl, Deborah Wiseman, about 14 years old, not so little, actually, but probably a little girl to him anyway, she was a student at a middle school in Providence, Rhode Island. They're a Jewish family. For years, the schools of Providence have called in various clergymen to give a kind of a little non-denominational prayer at high school graduation. Daniel Wiseman said, no, you don't. That's a violation of the First Amendment. You are in some way establishing religion. Case went all the way to the Supreme Court. It just came down. Quite frankly, I was expecting the Rehnquist Court to overturn precedent and establish prayers in the public schools as a matter of constitutional law. It's a little surprised when they said, no, you cannot do that. That's an improper mixture of church and state. And a lot of people said, well, wow, maybe constitutional law isn't moving as fast toward the end of time as we thought it was. I thought that myself until I got the opinion and read it. The guy who wrote this opinion, Justice Kennedy, Anthony Kennedy, decided that as a matter of fact, in this particular case, there was an improper usage of state power to enforce a religious act. But within this opinion is, in my opinion, a Trojan horse. Or to put it in 20th century language, I think there's a computer virus in there. Okay? The virus is his rationale. You remember that lemon test that I told you about, that a law is not constitutional if, number one, it doesn't have a secular purpose, Number two, it has an effect of establishing or prohibiting religion. And number three, it excessively entangles government and religion. Remember that test, that lemon test? In the Wiseman case, the lemon test was for all practical purposes discarded. Just like the test in the Smith case, the Sherbert test. Things we have relied on for 20 years as established constitutional law that protects the division between church and state have now been written out of the law in two recent opinions in the Supreme Court. What Mr. Justice Kennedy said was that we're going to find that in this particular case there was coercion, because that little gal's never going to have a graduation like that again. Her only choice is to stay home if she doesn't want to hear that prayer, and that's just not the kind of proper activity, you know, to keep a child away from. So he found coercion. What that means is that every case is just subject to the judgment of the court at that time. Is there or is there not coercion? The case was a 4-5 decision. It's that close. One vote would have changed it. When the composition of the court changes, the old lemon test that used to protect people from an unconstitutional invasion of a state passed law will no longer be there. And in his dissent, Justice Scalia angrily said, we should have made it okay to say prayers in school, and you've abandoned the lemon test and you've set up this silly test of coercion and it doesn't mean anything. And Scalia, who is the scholar on the court, is right. So we find ourselves in interesting and highly dynamic times. And I go back to that dream. A unified world in which the majority's view of morality becomes law. In which the Christian faith reunites under the umbrella and dogma of the oldest and largest Christian denomination. And once again, the world is safe for the majority. And that leaves only one obstacle: little groups of people who have religious convictions that say the dream isn't quite as neat as you think it is. And that brings us to what we'll talk about next hour: the New World Order and Adventism. Have those in the situation rooms of this world who are planning the great movements of history and planning our future, have they not only noticed the Soviet Union and the Constitution, but have they noticed us? And what plans do they have for us, if any? We'll talk about that next hour.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.